Hello, everybody. My name is Allison Bozong. I'm an optometrist practicing at Bascom Palmer Eye Institute in Miami, Florida. And I have the wonderful pleasure of having a panel of esteemed retina colleagues here on this production with us. So this is our discussion on success stories with vitreous opacities, a Mod Pod production. I wanted to take a moment just to introduce the panel here. So we have with us Dr. John Kitchens. He is practicing with Retina Associates of Kentucky in Lexington, Kentucky. We have Dr. Christina Wang, who is practicing at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Ed Ryan, who is practicing at Retina Consultants of Minnesota. And is it, I know I'm going to say the Twin Cities, but is it Edina or Edina? I always get it mixed up.
Edina.
Edina. So I was wrong on all accounts. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, we're really glad to have you guys here. And this podcast, I don't know if you've been tuning in before, but it's part of an ongoing educational initiative that we're using to discuss treatment options for symptomatic vitreous opacities, or floaters as we often call them, which is an issue that we commonly see in clinical practice, probably daily, but historically has been undertreated. Today, we're going to discuss the evolving paradigm in symptomatic vitreous opacities and delve into the role of diagnostics and severity grading for these opacities, as well as talk about some real-world considerations that we need to utilize when we're identifying these patients that might benefit from intervention and managing their expectations post-surgery. Now I want to hand it over to our moderator, Dr. John Kitchens.
So this podcast is a part of an ongoing educational initiative to discuss treatment options for symptomatic vitreous opacities, an issue we commonly see in clinical practice, but which has historically been undertreated. Today, we'll discuss the evolving paradigm in managing symptomatic vitreous opacities and whether surgery is becoming a more acceptable option. We'll explore the role of diagnostics and severity grading for symptomatic vitreous opacities. We'll talk about some real-world considerations for identifying patients, managing expectations, and just general pearls in having success with managing these patients. So let's jump in and get started. So Christina, let's start with you. At an academic institution, really is the paradigm changing in terms of the acceptability of a vitrectomy for symptomatic vitreous opacities?
It's interesting, John, because for such a common condition that most of us see every single day in our clinics, it's a very relatively controversial topic to talk about surgery for SVOs. And I think a lot of that stems from the fact that these patients are starting off generally with very good visual acuity. And, you know, a lot of the literature that we have, which is limited already, is really pretty dated and goes back to the era of 20 gauge surgery when things may not have been as safe as they are today. To answer your question, though, I do think the paradigm is slowly shifting, and that's because of a number of reasons. First of all, our instrumentation is getting better than ever. We have, you know, cut rates up to 20,000, aiming for higher as we speak. We have smaller gauge instrumentation. A lot of us work on 25, 27 gauge, which, you know, arguably can reduce the rate of iatrogenic tears, things like that. And additionally, we see how happy these patients can be after these types of surgeries. It really does make a meaningful difference in their quality of vision and their quality of life. And I think that the more we have these open discussions about PPV for SVO, sharing the bad and the good, right? There's always going to be complications with any type of surgery, but fortunately the rates are low. I do think that we're going to continue moving the needle here.
Ed, you have a unique perspective as someone who's really kind of led the way in managing symptomatic vitreous opacities with vitrectomy, but also having a perspective of 30 years of experience and seeing so many changes in retina. What do you think are the few things that have really led, from a technology standpoint, led to this sea change now where we're starting to manage these patients and make them better?
Well, thanks, John. I do think that this is changing. It's slowly increasing the volume of cases. And I think what's increasing the volume of cases is the volume of outcomes for cases, which are in 95% of the cases really quite good in a condition that even though visual acuity measures very good preoperatively, visual function is not good preoperatively, and the patients are extremely happy afterward. And so conservative or more conservative partners see that often enough and start changing their minds. So I think it's the progression of good outcomes that are influencing the surgeons to be a little more liberal in their application of this type of surgery. I do think that small gauge vitrectomy has changed things, not just in safety, but in, you know, such rapid recovery. I mean, often within a week, you can't tell which eyes had the surgery and the patients are thrilled. So it's the surgical procedure itself has improved quite a bit. Our understanding of what to expect has improved quite a bit. I think those are big drivers.
And Allison, we all on this panel do surgery for symptomatic vitreous opacities, but you really have your pulse on the, your finger on the pulse of general ophthalmology and optometry. There's a disconnect still between patients that are referred for symptomatic vitreous opacities to a retina specialist and those that are still sitting in clinics. Is there a lack of awareness in the optometric community as far as options for treatment?
I think that's a really great question. I don't know that there's as much a lack of awareness about the options. I think a lot of us are familiar with, yes, you can have, you know, vitrectomy surgery or, you know, potentially vitreolysis with a YAG laser. But I think one of the bigger issues that we face is there's an inconsistency in, you know, our retina colleagues and knowing who does what kind of surgeries, knowing, hey, if I have a patient that I want, you know, I want them to have the opportunity to have a certain surgery, you know, you might have to send it to a specific surgeon. So I think that there's, you know, that consistency isn't there across the board. And to be honest with you, I think that, you know, I think about this a lot. I would love to be just a fly on the wall in some of your, you know, retina meetings and just hear what's being discussed because these things get brought up. And as an optometrist, I'm not really privy to those discussions and we're not. So things like this podcast, I think are very helpful for us. Tuning in and hearing, you know, some of the good, some of the bad, and just the options and being more familiar with that is really fantastic. But I think if I had to say the biggest drawback, that biggest disconnect in referring our patients, it's because we don't know who to refer to which providers. We don't know what the outcome will be when we refer. Yeah.
And that's a great point, Allison. And I think the big concern is around safety. And so, Ed, should we be concerned about safety in vitrectomy for patients with symptomatic vitreous opacities? And how do you address this with patients?
Well, there are multiple different categories of settings of vitreous opacities. I will operate on some patients who have not yet had a posterior vitreous detachment. The risk for retinal detachment in that setting is definitely higher. And I explain that to the patients. And these are people who, you know, usually have pretty considerable opacities and are very desperate and they're willing to take that risk, as am I. And it could be as high as 5% or higher in that setting. Overall, the most accurate data I've seen for RD likelihood was a study looking at iris data, and it showed a 2.5% rate of retinal detachment. I followed my cases over time, and that's exactly what I see. So I tell patients that there's, you know, 2.5% risk of this, they have to understand that going in.
Christina, is there anything that can be done to mitigate some of these risks? And in general, what are your techniques? If you're speaking to a colleague who maybe hasn't done vitrectomy for symptomatic vitreous opacities, what are you going to relay to them as far as how to do it, you know, and some pearls as far as decreasing the risks, but having that great clinical impact?
It's really hard to say, John. And, you know, I've worked with you and Ed many times now with regards to this topic, and it's always fascinating to hear all the different approaches to something as straightforward as a pars plana vitrectomy, which we all do every single day. But when it comes to this indication, because we all have different thresholds, for example, you know, Ed just mentioned earlier that he's willing to perform this type of surgery on someone without a complete PVD. I also am the same way. I actually also may perform it on phakic patients. That really does change the risk profile for every single patient. And also depending on how your technique is in that particular patient can also have an impact. So for example, some surgeons really only perform a core vitrectomy and they feel like that can relieve most of the patient's symptoms. I, on the other hand, generally perform as complete of a vitrectomy as I feel like I safely can. But of course, the more that you're finagling out in the periphery, there's always a risk for iatrogenic tears and things like that to occur. I generally do like to induce a PVD, and Ed mentioned also that that is a riskier part of a procedure when you're having somebody who doesn't have a complete PVD yet. You can actually induce a retinal tear, which has happened. So it really does vary, but I think a couple of takeaways that are really important. Number one, you want to make sure you perform a 360 degree scleral depressed examination at the end of every single case, even if the patient already had a PVD. You can check and treat right away on the spot any tears that might have formed during that operation. And I think the other second pearl I can add is cover things thoroughly with the patient preoperatively. Things can happen with any patient in any case, even the ones that go perfectly smoothly. And it's important that they're prepared for that.
And Christina, are there any patients that you look at and say, hey, you're just not someone that I'm going to do the surgery on, even though they're bothered, like inferior lattice, history of retinal detachment in the fellow eye? Are there any absolute contraindications?
You know, for me, it's tough because, you know, sometimes you have a monocular patient, for example, who lost their other eye to a regmatogenous retinal detachment, and that might not seem like the ideal patient. On the other hand, you can see why their symptomatic vitreous opacities might be especially bothersome because that's the eye they're solely depending on. So I would say, you know, absolute contraindications, no, but of course, anyone with pre-existing retinal pathology, anyone who doesn't have a complete PVD or is phakic, there are different thresholds. They need to be more symptomatic than somebody who's pseudophakic with a complete PVD and no pathology for me to take them to the OR.
And Ed, for you, are there any contraindications?
Relative, not absolute. I agree exactly with what Christine was saying. This is shared decision-making. So that patient who may have one eye, and I just did that on a Stickler's patient who had such horrible floaters in the one remaining eye, I was very, very, very apprehensive about doing surgery. The patient is thrilled. But you know, you have that increased worry. And so there are relative contraindications.
So let's transition over to talking to patients in the clinic. And Allison, I think you'd be a great person because you're on the front line of all of this. What are some of the things that you like to elicit from patients when they come in noting that they're having some vitreous opacities?
Yeah. So I think, you know, as optometrists, we do a lot of comprehensive eye care. And so we really get to the root of a lot of different issues during the same visit and try to kind of touch on everything. So for me, I oftentimes like to ask these patients who are, you know, symptomatic for opacities, how often they're thinking about them. So, you know, how often do you find yourself thinking about those spots in your vision throughout the day? Is it every day? Is it, you know, multiple times a day? Or is it like once a week? That gives me an idea of, you know, how often it's crossing their mind, because oftentimes something that's crossing your mind multiple times a day is very disruptive. And then also, you know, similar to our cataract surgery patients, you know, you've got a little bit of a, you know, NS, but maybe not quite at the surgical threshold yet, but, you know, we ask about glare. Can you drive? Can you do the things you like to do? If you're an avid golfer, can you play golf, or is your vision impacting that? So asking in terms of, you know, putting it into a day-to-day life scenario, their activities of daily living, seeing how often it's impacting those things that they like to do that, you know, really bring them happiness, bring them joy, or, you know, maybe it's interfering with work. So something like that. Those are questions that I like to ask to get an idea about their actual day-to-day situation, how much it's impacting them.
And you're using a formal rating scale, or are you just kind of going off what the patients are telling you?
I don't use a formal grading scale in clinic. I like the scales with the faces, you know, the really grumpy, mad face, the one that's not really sure, the happy face. I like that. I think patients will love that and kind of think it's funny, but I don't use a scale. I just sort of go off of their complaints and their symptoms. And then also I try to match it with what I'm seeing. So if I'm seeing a big, you know, honking opacity right above the macula, you know, and their symptoms make sense with that, that's going to go into the more severe category for me.
And Christina, how well can you correlate with what you see on exam with how impacted the patient is?
It can be really hard to make that correlation. And I know some of my colleagues, I know Ed really is an expert in a lot of the different imaging modalities like SLO that can be used to help draw sort of objective presence, medic vitreous opacities that they're so complaining about. I'm sort of on the other end of the spectrum, to be honest. I don't do a whole lot of ancillary imaging because we know that the correlation with their visual symptoms and even with visual acuity is really not very tight. And to some extent in this particular condition, you know, perception is reality. So their subjective complaints really do hold a lot of meaning to me, especially if they've been persistent. So I have a mandatory minimum 6-month waiting period for them to see if observation can help mitigate what they're complaining of. And if they don't, regardless if I see significant opacities on, you know, B-scan or OCT or any of those other imaging modalities, I will consider surgery for those patients. Now, that being said, I do think there's a really significant need for the role of diagnostics in this particular condition. If we can objectively measure these in a better way, if we can validate those measures to correlate somehow to outcomes from surgery, count me in for sure. But I generally will, you know, like Allison mentioned, really track their, you know, subjective complaints really carefully.
And you've got a unique way of doing videography. Can you describe how you do that to document patients' vitreous opacities?
Well, we use Heidelberg OCT machines in all our offices, and they have something called MovieMax, which is a way to record SLO images on video. And you can either use a 30-degree lens. I prefer the 55. Which gives you a great sense of what's affecting their vision. I mean, then, you know, it shows you more than just the central vision, but I have the patients fixate, then perform a saccade, then refixate. And you can absolutely see when their macula is completely occluded by prominent opacities. At that point in their daily living, they're not seeing out of that eye. So it really correlates very well with the symptoms I hear from patients.
And I would encourage everyone to look and watch Ed's video. It's really amazing to see how well you can visualize these vitreous opacities. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with discussion about treatment options and the impact on quality of life. So we've touched on some reasons why vitrectomy is becoming more acceptable for symptomatic vitreous opacities. And we talked about strategies for identifying patients who would benefit, but surgery is not the only thing we can offer patients. Christina, where does watchful waiting fit in with these patients?
Well, watchful waiting fits in for everybody, in my opinion. So everyone who comes to my office for the first time, in general, if they're complaining about symptomatic vitreous opacities, there's a 6-month period. So I'll first of all, I think it's important to acknowledge that indeed, I see on the examination what they're complaining about. I think that really puts their mind at ease. It makes them feel like they're not, you know, some of them worry that they're losing their mind or that they're going crazy. I validate that for them. And I tell them that fortunately, because of neuroadaptation or settling or continued evolution of vitreous opacity, sometimes they might not notice them over a period of time. So I'll set a follow-up appointment for 6 months from that point. And I tell them at that first visit, I'll say, if you're still as bothered as you are today, when you come back and see me next time, we'll chat about surgery and how we can fix these for you. And I find that that gives them peace of mind. And that honestly, I would say over 95% of patients will have resolution of their symptoms by the time that they follow up. And so those are patients you don't want to be performing surgery for. You know, if they're going to get adjusted in 6 months, there's no reason to put a patient at risk and to have them go through surgery. But for that small proportion where those symptoms are persistent and you really have now evidence and documentation that indeed it's affecting their visual, you know, acuity and their quality of life and their quality of vision, those are great candidates to take for parsplaneal vitrectomy.
Wise words, Christina. Ed, what about laser? There's a lot of talk about laser for vitreous opacities. Where does that fit in?
We don't use it. We don't anticipate that we're going to use it. I think there are some patients with particular anatomies, and that is a discrete Weiss ring. where it appears to be helpful, but we don't find it often enough helpful. We see a lot of patients who had it and it failed, and they end up having vitrectomy by us. So we either encourage what Christina mentioned, and I'm impressed that we all have very similar approaches, and that is watchful waiting, because many of those patients, they're not sure if it went away or they just got used to it. It's probably a lot of both. And most of them don't need anything done. So I think most of the candidates where laser might be helpful actually probably don't even need the procedure. If they do, I'd get a vitrectomy because I think it works every time, at least to get the opacity out.
I tell our fellows oftentimes with epiretinal membranes and vitreous opacities, you'll never regret the surgery you don't do. So always be patient with those things. And the ones that are obvious and need to be done will present themselves. Christina, what should we be telling our patients about outcomes? And this really is, I think, most important for Allison and her colleagues to hear. Like, what should they be telling patients about the potential outcomes for vitrectomy for vitreous opacities?
Well, I think, first of all, John, these SVOs are so bothersome. They're so intrusive for the small fraction of patients that have already made it into your clinic, right? They've probably already seen other colleagues of ours, not in retina, and really their complaints have persisted that they've landed in our chair. So the first thing to really reassure them of is not only that you see what they're talking about when you examine them or perform those images, but also to reassure them that we have a very effective treatment option, like Ed said. And that brings them such a sense of relief, I can't even tell you. And then I go into sort of the more nuanced discussion about pars plana vitrectomy and some of the risks, because it is important. I usually start off by telling them 99.9% of patients are extremely happy with the outcome after this type of surgery. But I also really do a pretty comprehensive coverage of all of the possible risks and adverse events that can happen, because even if the risks are 2% or lower, which they are across the board for most of the potential adverse outcomes that can happen, it's 100% if it happens to that particular patient, right? So I cover everything from the possibility of persistent, you know, vitreous opacities that can still happen after a surgery, especially if the patient doesn't have a full PVD and you don't induce one intraoperatively. If they're phakic, I talk to them about cataract progression. And then I talk about some of the more serious things like endophthalmitis, retinal tears, and retinal detachments. They have to be prepared that it's a low but probable chance that they could come out, that they could come out with gas or an air tamponade, for example. All of those things are important to cover for each patient.
And Allison, obviously your experience is going to be more limited, but what are you hearing back from patients that have had this procedure performed? What's the feedback you're getting?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the you know, rare patient that I have had that's had this done, you know, would be generally a success story. I mean, I think that it's a mixture of the patient being properly selected from the get-go, so they go through a pretty fine sieve to get to that point. But I think once the right patient would be selected, I think it's a very valuable option for them.
Ed, you have a colleague that comes to you and says, you know, I've not done surgery for vitreous opacities, but I'm thinking about doing it. What's going to be the one pearl or one bit of advice you're going to give them that kind of says, hey, this is okay, you can do this?
Well, it's that, and we hear this all the time at meetings, and it's sort of a side kind of sotto voce. Those patients, they're the happiest patients that we have. And it really is true. And you hear that often enough, you start to think that, gee, this is a legitimate thing we're doing for people. After being, you know, 10 years ago told that, boy, you shouldn't be doing that. That's the wrong thing to do. Well, it's not the wrong, it's the right thing to do in the right setting. And that's what I would tell colleagues, and they're hearing that enough, they're figuring it out anyway.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the thing that really speaks to me is the fact that we track our surgeries that we do. And 5 years ago, our number one procedure that we did was epiretinal membrane. Number two was macular hole. Now the number one procedure that we do is surgery for vitreous opacities. Number two, still epiretinal membrane. Number three is macular hole, and then detachment and diabetic vitreous hemorrhage cases are the four and five. but it is number one, and it's become number one over the last 3 years, and it's just increasing in numbers. And I think it's because we've hit that tipping point. I guess to close up, Christina, what would be some advice or pearls that you can give to optometrists and retina specialists about managing patients with symptomatic vitreous opacities?
Yeah, I think that the most important thing is really, again, just acknowledging their symptoms, let them know that this is a really common pathology that we see and that there are very safe and effective ways of treating it these days. You know, I think the consensus amongst retina specialists in general is that there should be a waiting period. A lot of us use the 6-month cutoff, although that's somewhat arbitrary, but following patients for a finite time that gives them enough of an opportunity to potentially self-resolve in terms of symptoms is important, but not to drag that on forever. And so a lot of times I'll just make a note in the chart and say, if the patient still has symptoms at next visit, you know, consider surgery or open up surgery discussion. And I think for some of my optometry and non-retina colleagues, putting that same note in their chart, but saying the threshold being referred to a retina specialist is also a really important one, because it's sad to me that there are patients who are sitting around living with lower quality of vision and potentially quality of life when there could be something relatively straightforward that could help them immensely.